Well, Christian friends, brothers and sisters, do you wish you had more joy? Do you ever worry about what God really thinks about you? Do you find it hard to admit when you're wrong? Does giving up all for Jesus sound like a threat? Do you walk around feeling frustrated and angry? And actually, you don't really know why. And do you compare yourself with other Christians? You do it habitually. It goes on all the time, and you're either feeling smug or you're feeling inadequate. Well, to answer those questions and more, over the next, at least the next couple of Sundays, we're going to be looking at the parable of the two sons. Because at the heart of all those questions lies a misunderstanding of God and a misunderstanding of the gospel. We can be Christians, we can be Christians for years, we can be Christians for decades, and still fail to grasp the grace of God. So please have that reading open in front of you, Luke chapter 15, and verses 11 to 32, although we're not going to look at the second part of the parable. Have it open in front of you. Now, Jesus is answering a complaint. Verse 1, then all the tax collectors and sinners drew near to him to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, this man receives, or this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Then he said, verse 11, a certain man had two sons. So this parable is an answer to a question. This man welcomes sinners. Here is one of Jesus' answers. As you know, he tells three parables, but this is one of his answers. Well, this morning he's going to look at the younger son. So we're going to look at verses 11 to 24. We'll look at it under four headings, and then we'll draw the lesson. So point number one, a family divided. Verse 11, then he said, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me. So he divided to them his livelihood. You can see what the son is saying. Dad, I wish you were dead, but you're not dead. So can I have my share of the inheritance now? I can't be stuck around on this farm waiting for years for you to die to get my inheritance. I want it now, and please give it to me in cash, something I can that'll be useful to me. That's a shameful request, isn't it? And to Jesus' Jewish hearers, it's a shameful response. Verse 12, so he divided to them his livelihood. It's an astonishing thing. The father pays up. And Jesus' hearers are thinking, well, what is he doing? It's such a weak response. This man, this father, he has no honor. He should have disinherited that son on the spot. But instead he caves in and gives him his share. Verse 13, and not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country. And now the family breakdown is complete. He wishes his father was dead. He rejects his father's love. He doesn't just move out. He actually gets as far away from dad as he possibly can. He journeys to a far country. And now that his father breathing down his neck, he's free to do as he likes, and he does, verse 13. And there he wasted his possessions with prodigal living. What's prodigal living? Well, it's wild living. It's rakish behavior. But of course, this is a parable, and it's an everyday story that opens a door on spiritual truth. So who is this son? Well, it's me. What's the word you never have to teach a child? Give me. Father, give me. Because this is a world of takers. More than that, I've initiated a family breakdown, haven't I? I wish God was dead. I've rejected his love. And I've moved as far from God as I possibly can to live as I please. That's my unconverted days. That's where I am this morning, if I don't know Christ. Well, point number two, we'll call wasted. What happens to our young man? Well, he gets wasted, doesn't he? Verse 13, and not many days after, the younger son gathered all together, journeyed to a far country, and there he and there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. When I walk out on God, I waste everything that God has given to me. I waste my life, my health, my energy, my relationships. I waste my time, gifts, opportunities, possessions, money. I waste everything. It all comes from him. And what do? I spend it on myself. I waste the lot. And there wasted his possessions with prodigal living. In the far country, what do? We lay our lives to waste. But it gets worse. Verse 14. But when he had spent all, there arose a severe famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine, to feed pigs. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. So the money runs out. And his friends abandon him, and now he's really in trouble, isn't he? The good times are over. They didn't last very long. They never do in the far country. And now his choices are catching up with him. He began to be in want. He's having to do without. Jobs are scarce. There's a famine. If he's going to survive, there's nothing left for him to do than to hire himself out. That's exactly what he does do. He hires himself out. He's now no better than a slave. And his humiliation is complete. Think of it, a Jewish lad feeding unclean pigs. In fact, things are so bad that the pigs are better off than he is. He actually wants to eat what the pigs are eating. They're better fed than he is. A couple of summers ago, we stayed on a farm which had 3,000 pigs. And the smell, and the flies, and the noise. And when you get near to pigs, there's a certain sort of animal heat. You know what I mean? It's sort of, you can feel the, because it all sort of in, what's that, a great scrum of pigs. And you can actually just feel the animal heat radiating out. And all the little piggy faces looking at you. And with eyes that look almost human. Only they're dead eyes. They're dull eyes. They just stare at you. And then when the food comes, the squealing and the grunting and the pushing and the shoving and the biting. And then they've all got their snouts in the trough. Here's a lad who says, I wish I was among them. I wish I could eat what they're eating. To envy the pigs. To think I could be satisfied with what the pigs are eating. And he would have gladly filled his stomach with the pods that the swine ate, and no one gave him anything. In fact, to Jesus' Jewish hearers, the picture is shocking beyond words. What's the most shameful thing you can think of? What makes your stomach turn over? Now, most of us here are probably Gentiles, aren't we? I mean, you know, pigs are pigs, but we've eaten pork and all the rest of it. We're happy with pigs. These are Jews. Pigs. What makes your stomach turn over? What makes you wretch? What gives you that horrible thud in the stomach? And you're horrified at the very thought of it. That's how they would have felt about this lad. So when we break free of God's love, where do we end up? We end up in the pigsty, don't we? Trying to satisfy ourselves with rubbish. When you're starving, when you're empty, you will eat anything. Which, of course, is why we have a personal history. A personal history of which we are utterly, utterly ashamed. Do you want others to know what you did in the far country? No. Of course not. Which, of course, is why we begin to hate our lives in the far country. You see, all these dreams of freedom when we break free of God, it's an illusion, isn't it? Then he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. He's no better than a slave. You need to understand this. If you're not a Christian, if you are a Christian, sin doesn't give you choices. When you put other things in the place of God, other things in the place of Christ, you have no choices. It's one of the great massive lies. Sin gives you options, choices. No, it doesn't. It's a lie. Just as much as a lie if I said, go outside that railway line and you see that nice shiny rail? There's no electricity going through that. Just step on that rail. You'll be fine. Jesus said, whoever commits sin is a slave to sin. Sin is never original, new, fresh, satisfying. Sin is dull, boring, repetitive, monotonous. It grinds you down. And it destroys your identity. And so we need to wake up to that. Because you've yet to come to Christ. It's the freedom of the pigsty. It leaves you filthy. You see, when we leave home, when we walk out on God, what happens? Life is shameful. Here's our man. He's emaciated, empty, wasted, and he's caked in pig excrement. That's where walking out on God takes us. And it's worse than that, isn't it? What does the Father say? For this my son was dead. The wages of sin is death. Not ashes to ashes, dust to dust, but the punishment of hell. And of course, it's no good looking for help in the far country. What do we read? Verse 16, no one gave him anything. In a world of takers, everyone is out for himself. No one will give you anything. To leave home. To move far from God. To break free of his love is ultimately to lose everything. Well, point number three is the way back. Now, our young man has reached rock bottom, hasn't he? But he's starting to think. It's good, isn't it? It's good to think. Verse 17. But when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have bread enough to spare, and I perish with hunger? He's starting to think, I must have been mad to leave home. I'm worse off than one of my father's employees. So what am I going to do? Well, probably the first thought he's had is, I've blown it. I've messed up. Or have I? Have I blown it? Verse 18, I will arise. I'll go to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. I will arise and go to my father. I'll say to him, I've wronged you. I've sinned. Forgive me. And forget that I was ever your son. But give me a second chance. Let me in some way prove myself. Let me pay back in some way all the hurt that I've caused. Take me back as a hired servant. Maybe the thought that's going through his mind is, well, let me earn my way back into your society. Let me earn my way back into your love and into your affection and into your embrace. And the boy who once said, give me, is now the boy who's thinking, he's going to say to his father, make me. Make me like one of your hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. Christian friend, do you remember when you came to your senses? And there was that thought, wasn't it? I perish. And for the first time in your life, you were thinking clearly. For the first time in your life, you began to see. I will arise. I will go to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. And in that moment, all that mattered was getting right with God. And in that moment, you recognize that you wanted him more than anyone or anything else in the world. You'll have him on any terms. And so you left the pigsty. You left the far country. And you came home. Maybe it was with tears. Tears of repentance. And you came, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. Look at what I've become. I never thought it would end like this. What sort of reception did you receive? So point number four. The welcoming God. Well, the son gets up, starts for home. But will his plan work? What will his father say to him? What sort of reception can he expect? Think of it, he's hated his father, shamed his family, gone with prostitutes, ended up in the pigsty. Surely he's the most shameful sinner imaginable. And that's why Jesus' hearers, at this point, they know exactly what this son can expect. They know what's coming to him. A few weeks back, Robin Asghar was telling us about a conversation he had with some Muslim lads. And he's telling them this very parable, Jesus' parable. And when Robin told them the story, up to verse 20. Okay? So up to, he arose and came to his father. And then Robin asked, what should happen to this son? When he comes home, what should the father do with him? And some said, well, he should be disowned. His father should throw him out. Some of them said, this son should be beaten. He should be punished. While the lad said, this son should be killed. He so shamed his family. So you see, Jesus' hearers know exactly what's coming, don't they? They know what's coming to this boy. You can see them. You can just look at their faces, can't you? You can see that the eyes, they're glowing, and there's a certain little smiles beginning to appear, and they know what's going to happen next. You know, the outraged father, he's going to publicly humiliate his son. He's going to beat him. He's going to disown him. Maybe even worse. Because he's dishonored the family. And they're thinking, well, it's nothing less than this lad deserves. So what happens? Verse 20. He arose, came to his father. But when he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. Did you hear that? What does the father do? He runs to meet him. Oh, Jesus here is thinking, the shame, the shame. Men of his age don't pull up their robes and run. They don't hug and kiss a pig stinking sinner. But that's exactly what this father does. His father saw him, had compassion, he runs, he embraces him, he kisses him. And it is shocking, isn't it? The father's behavior is more shocking than the wicked behavior of his son. So when Robin told these lads, these Muslim lads, what the father did, they couldn't believe it. He said one of the boys had his head in his hands, shaking his head. They couldn't believe that a father would ever do something like this. What sort of father is this? What's going on? This boy comes no more within reach. He just comes in reach, isn't he? Well, he's a great way off. Hasn't even got home yet. He's still a great way off. But as soon as the father sees him, his heart is in his mouth. It's my son. And he's overwhelmed with love for his son. And he runs towards him with outstretched arms. And you can hear him, perhaps even as he's running, saying, my son, my son. And when they meet, he hugs him and holds him and embraces him and kisses him. Verse 21, the son doesn't even get to finish his little prepared speech before the father lavishes his love upon him. Oh, there's no need to prove yourself. I know you're sorry. I know you're sorry because you've come home. Instead of waiting for the son to honor his father, what does the father do? He honors the son. That's extraordinary, isn't it? Even more extraordinary. He's honoring his son. But the father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring out the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again, and he was lost and is found. And they began to be merry. They began to celebrate. Oh, it felt like a bereavement. I thought this my son was dead, but not today. He's come home. It's time to celebrate. Well, that's the parable thus far. God willing, look at the rest of it next week. But I just want to close with one lesson. And the lesson is the grace of God. Now, what does the returning son seek? Look at verse 18. This is what he's seeking. I will arise, I will go to my father, I will say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So the son says three things, doesn't he? Well, he's planning to say three things. Father, I've sinned. I'm not worthy to be called your son. And take me back as one of your hired servants. In other words, the sense of what he's saying is, let me make amends for all the wrongs that I've done. Take me back as a hired servant. Give me a second chance. Let me prove myself. How does the father respond? Verse 21. And the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring out the fatted calf here and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. So it's very important, this. What does the father do? He hears his confession of sin, doesn't he? He acknowledges that he's not behaved like a son. But the father cuts him off before he can say, make me like one of your hired servants. That's very significant, isn't it? He doesn't let him say it. He cuts him off. There's a but in there because his father interjects. Make amends for what you've done. Prove yourself worthy of my love. The father says, I will not hear of it. You don't have to win me over. You don't have to justify yourself. You don't have to, as it were, have to earn your way back into my love. Because I love you freely. While you were a great way off, I saw you. My heart was in my throat and I ran to you. My son, my son, my son. I've always loved you. I've never stopped loving you. I will never stop loving you. Because you're my son. And you're freely loved and freely, freely forgiven. Welcome home. You're not coming back as a hired servant. Coming back as my son. And of course you wonder if the father's really reformed, because we read of music and dancing and celebration. Verse 32, it was right that we should make merry and be glad, for your brother was dead and is alive again and was lost and is found. Father says it was right. What else do you expect me to do other than to have a party? What else do you expect me to do other than to lead the singing and to dance for joy? What else do you expect me to do? Because my cherished son, the son that I love, he's come home. Now, Christian friends, have you grasped this? Port Isaac Fisherman's Friends. It's a singing group, isn't it? Yes? Some blank faces. Some people know who they are. Port Isaac's Fisherman's Friends. Anyway, someone keeps playing their music in our house, all right? It's not me. But there's a song, and in the song it's got this chorus, okay? And it says, come, all you no-hopers, you jokers and rogues. Okay? And Christian friends, that was us, wasn't it? We wish God was dead. We rejected his love. We wasted our lives. And only when we were perishing in the pigsty did we come to our senses. Come, all you no-hopers, you jokers and rogues. Face up to what you are. You're a no-hoper, aren't you? You know, sometimes we think we've got an education. You know, I brush up quite nicely. I've got friends. I can do this. I can do that. I've made some success of my life. I've achieved things. I've done this, done that. The bottom line is I'm a no-hoper. I'm a joker. I'm a rogue. That's exactly what I am. It's all I've ever been. and I've come from the pigsty. And when we come back to God, we return emaciated, caked in filth. Don't have any high thoughts of yourself. You're a no-hoper. You're a joker. You're a rogue. That's all you've ever been. But we came back, didn't we? And maybe it was with tears of repentance. And what did the Lord do? After all, this is a parable, isn't it? It's to answer the charge, this man welcomes sinners. So what did the Lord do? Did he send someone to meet you? Did he shout at you? Did he say, you sit there, you don't move, you've caused enough trouble already? Did he give you the cold shoulder? Because that's what you do, isn't it, to some people? When other people let you down, you give them the cold shoulder. So maybe God gave you the cold shoulder. And prove that you're sorry. Prove by years of hired service that you're worthy of my love. Is that what he did? What did he do? He ran to meet you. That's what he did. He ran to meet you with open arms. When he was still a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion, and he ran, fell on his neck. You fall on someone's neck because you're running so hard and so fast, aren't you? You're not shaking hands. You're crashing into them. Because you can't wait to get to them. And you fall on them. And you hold them. And you kiss them. And that's what God did with us. He was in a hurry to save me. And Christian friend, he never ever gave you the chance to say, make me like one of your hired servants. He cut you off before you could ever say that. Let me prove myself, the father says, no, 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 I'll have none of that. You're not going to try and come back and prove yourself and show you're worthy of my love. I won't have it. And far from doing anything for him, he did it all for you, didn't he? That's grace. Look at verses 22 and 23. The father said to his servants, bring out the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand, sandals on his feet. He hasn't even got anything on his feet. And bring out the fatted calf and bring the fatted calf here and kill it. And let us eat and be merry. Now, once I was a taker. Once my language with God was, give me, give me, give me. But when he saved me, he said, it's okay to take. Take, 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 take. Have as much as you want. Take it all. With no account of the extravagance. That's grace. That's the grace of God. Saying, take it all. It's undeserved, of course it is, but take it. Do you think of grace as something that God dispenses at arm's length? You know? Like sending a servant to meet you as you sort of arrive at the house. Stephen, you want to put up the definition of grace? Okay. Simon Doyle and I have been having an email conversation about grace. And Simon's been coming up with definitions, and I've been poking him in the eye sometimes or prodding him in the ribs. And this is what Simon's come up with. Okay, this is grace, isn't it? What is grace? Far from being an impersonal force, power, or energy, something that God dispenses at arm's length, something that God gets a servant to give you, grace is the loving heart and hand of the living and covenant-keeping God, freely, unconditionally, and generously choosing, calling, quickening, pardoning, accepting, sanctifying, preserving, and glorifying his undeserving and unlovely but deeply cherished people, and giving himself in the entirety of his being, powers, and indeed life to them, purely because of the Son's saving work and their union with him. I'll just go back to the previous one, Stephen, if you could. Thank you. It's not being put in a nice shape because that looks nice. Okay? It's put in that shape because the whole sense of it's the Father giving himself, grace freely fountaining out of the Godhead, poured out. But it's not something that's poured out. It's God pouring himself out, isn't it? Covenant keeping is the God who promises to love us always and never ever to let us go. It's free. It's unconditional. It's generous. Next one, please, Stephen. His undeserving and unlovely but deeply cherished people. And God gives himself in the entirety of his being. Thank you, Stephen. You see, it's all of God. All of grace. And it's undeserved. That's the whole point. That's what grace is. You don't have to earn it. You don't have to hire yourself out for 20 years before you get something from God. It's undeserved. And it's for the unlovely. That's exactly the point. Who's telling the story? The Son of God. And it's God himself who runs to meet us. And it's God who gives himself to us. And the reason for his love is not found in us. The reason for his love is found in him. It all flows unconditionally from him. If we can say this reverently, it's hardwired into God. Because that's the loving God that he is. And when we doubt it, remember what Romans says. God demonstrates his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, while we were still caked in pig excrement, Christ died for us. Because that's the God that he is. And you can only love and worship and adore such a God. Now, I want to hit one nail really hard this morning. Because the more and more I go through the Christian life, the more and more I come to realize that God's people don't get it. Do I get it? The grace of God. It seems so hardwired into us to say, make me, let me do something to show that I'm worthy of your love. And God says, no, 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 no. So Christian friend, have you got it? Maybe your parents were hard on you. Maybe your childhood was insecure. Maybe you're the sort of person who only really made friends and could only find acceptance by as it were, proving something. You had to be a certain sort of person to fit in. Or maybe you grew up in a church where the preaching was all sin and judgment and you looked upon God as a sort of hard man. And you always feel you have to prove yourself. You have to justify your existence. And you've carried all that into the Christian life. And you think, well, God, does God really love me? How could God love me? And will God still love me when I let him down? Will he still love me when I sin? Maybe you feel my Heavenly Father, the Lord Jesus Christ, he's a hard man. And I've got to therefore show myself worthy of his love by years and years and years of sacrificial service. That's why the thought of giving up all for Christ horrifies you, because you just see it in those terms. Sacrificial service to prove something so that he'll love me. And you feel so insecure. And you feel in some sort of nondescript way guilty all the time. You think, I'm just go around feeling guilty. So preaching on sin or whatever, it's always going to hit its mark because you're always feeling guilty. And you live the Christian life, you don't feel any real joy. And maybe you feel I've got to put in one winning performance after another to keep God on my side. So I've got to be a better parent, a better wife, a better husband, a better preacher, a better employee, a better friend. I've got to put in one winning performance after another to prove to God that I'm worthy of his love. And you bully yourself all the time. Try harder. Do better. Slapping yourself around the face. Go on. Get out there. And I'm despairing, aren't I? Because I can't keep it up. I can't live like that. It's killing me. And what is it you're saying, Christian friend? You're saying all the time, make me like one of your hired servants. But is that what the Father wants? He's the God of grace, isn't he? We've seen the heart of God. He loves freely the undeserving and the unlovely. He didn't wait for the Son to get back and prove himself. He ran to meet the Son while he was a great way off. And Christian friend, he runs to meet you. And his arms are always open. And he gives himself. And he loved you when you were in the pigsty. And he's lavished the bounty of heaven upon you. And he's given his Son to save you. And what does he say, verse 23? And bring the fatted calf here and kill it. And let us eat and be merry. It doesn't say let's get the vegetarian option. The fatted calf, the thing you put to one side, the very best. You've been fattening it up, feeding it. For such a moment as this, for celebration. Are we going to cry our tears at that party and say, I can't, I'm not worthy, I'm a wicked son, how can you ever possibly love someone like me? I'm too sinful. When the Father says, rejoice, I can't. But what does he say, verse 32? It was right that we should make merry. Christian friend, there's no hardness in him. The only time his smile was taken away was when you rejected his love and you went to the far country. Make me like one of your hired servants. Let me pay my way. Let me prove myself. Let me show I'm worthy of your love. And he won't hear of it. Do you remember a few weeks ago we thought about B.B. Warfield? And it was on his honeymoon that his wife and he were caught in a thunderstorm. Do you remember? And the experience so shocked his wife Annie that she became an invalid. So on their honeymoon, she became an invalid. And he cared for her for 38 years. He never left her for more than 2 hours at a time. He was always back at home every 2 hours to be with his wife. In the words of one of his students, the gentleness of his manner was striking proof of the loving care with which he surrounded her. Now, brothers and sisters, that is the power of covenant love, isn't it? That's the power of the love which says, I will love you, for better, for worse, in sickness and in health. And it's a faint, faint picture of Christ's love for his bride. Did Annie feel insecure? Did Warfield send someone else to care for her? Did Annie have to put in one anxious performance after another when she couldn't because she was an invalid? But one anxious performance after another just to keep her husband faithful, just to keep her husband at her side? That would be a tyranny, wouldn't it? You think, what sort of husband was he? His promise to love her would be worthless. Well, if it's unthinkable for the godly Warfield to behave in such a way, how much more unthinkable is it that our Jesus should ever be like that? That I've got to somehow perform for him, otherwise he'll abandon me and he'll stop loving me. Does he want his bride to feel insecure in his presence? One anxious performance after another, just to keep him on side, just to keep his love? What sort of marriage would that be? What sort of grace is that? What sort of bridegroom is that? Christian friends, he's given himself to us in the entirety of his being. He's given everything. He's given himself. Because that's grace. It's got nothing to do with me, that I'm lovely or lovable. I'm not. It's all to do with him. Because that is the God that he is. So do you see all these fears that you have? And maybe it's been driving your Christian life for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. All these fears, they don't flow from him. They flow from my silly heart. And we misunderstand him. We think he's like us. Because when others don't perform for me, I cold shoulder them. And we think he's like that. But that's what I'm like. He's not like that. So come, Christian friends, this morning. Let's eat and drink and dance and rejoice with our God. we've come home. Because this man welcomes sinners and eats with them.